This is All Things Peoria. I'm Daniel Musisi. Scientists at the Peoria Ag Lab are developing a jet biofuel from soybean oil. Researchers Ken Dahl and Brian Moser talked to Tim Shelley about the potential benefits of the new process.
A lot of people have done a lot of work on determining, you know, how good are biofuels for the environment now. And I don't have a specific on that. But from our perspective, it is good, certainly good to have kind of a domestic source of fuels for that, and the jet fuel market is big. And the other thing that I think is good about some of these type of technologies is, we do this with soy-based fuels, but any oil that had a significant amount of oleic acid in it would work with this technology. And so that's part of our thing as well, is not necessarily just food soybean oil. That we wouldn't necessarily need to put just food soybean oil, but potentially other crop oils and other materials. And that's part of what our biodiesel team had been working on for a while, was a lot of alternative feedstocks for these. And this would be something that would be potentially useful in those technologies as well.
So this could be used not only for soy, but also for, you mentioned other plants. What other plants might be usable?
Well, we've done a lot of, around the local area, there's a lot of pennycress that has received a fair bit of attention. That type of oil would work well. In theory, you could use, canola oil as well, or one of those type of oils, which... those aren't as popular in Illinois, but a lot of people like to grow that type of oil on land that is not as soy friendly. Something off season like pennycress would be good. I don't know. I guess I'd have to defer to Brian if any of these algal oils or anything like that would be applicable. I mean, it kind of depends on the actual structures in the oil.
Fuels are a high volume, low cost, low profit market. So you need a very cheap process to compete economically with the current petrochemical fuels. And so that's an area where, although the algal oils might produce fuels with appropriate and favorable properties, they might simply just be too expensive with current technology. And so that's why we're focusing more on these plant oils like soybean, canola, pennycress, and others that are enriched in oleic acid, because oleic acid is the fatty acid that is most favorable for producing these aromatics and hydrocarbons using our technology.
You want a process that's basically, it's cheap. You're not spending more to make fuel than you are necessarily to, you're making off of it, so to speak. So this is a process you believe is commercially viable to reproduce or scale up.
So we're kind of at the stage right now with this technology where we'd like to get, if we could get like some actual fuel producers on board, get exactly what they need and what kind of reactors and things they use. So the reactors we use are, small scale reactors that we use in the lab. ARS kind of does a lot of that type research where we develop something in the lab scale, and then we reach out to industrial partners to try to help us. I would say our technology is still certainly lab scale at this point. And so, we've done some assessments, and we think, there's a chance that it could be something good, and because of the ability to use different feedstocks, but at current scales, it would not be economic.
Yeah, the feedstock cost is an important consideration, because if you were to use soybean oil that you can buy at Kroger that's been refined, bleached, and deodorized and processed for food applications, that's going to be too expensive. So we're looking at using less expensive oils or crude oils that haven't been refined yet to help lower those costs, as Ken mentioned, and hopefully a commercial partner would be able to help us with that.
It's kind of an exciting prospect, though, to think that this could be a new possibility for farmers, I guess, for the jet industry, airplanes, and I don't know, the environment, honestly. It provides a lot of possibilities, though.
Yeah, it's an exciting technology. And like I said, we're glad that, you know, we're kind of glad we're working on it. And like I said, we try, that's part of our mission at the lab, is to, you know, get the most out of agricultural commodities that we can. And we think that this is certainly well within our mission. And it's kind of a, you know, marathon or whatever, as opposed to a sprint on these processes.
That's Ken Dahl and Brian Moser speaking to Tim Shelley about the new jet biofuel under development at the Peoria Ag Lab. And in 6 minutes on All Things Peoria, catch my conversation with artist and art review editor Daniel Ackley. He talks about how he gained his vision as an adult and why he started a Central Illinois arts publication. This is All Things Peoria. I'm Daniel Musisi. Arguably the most prominent figure in Bradley University sports history recently took his place in the National Collegiate Basketball Hall of Fame. Hersey Hawkins remains the Braves' all-time leading scorer, and the team retired his uniform number 33. Joe Deacon has more with Hawkins following his induction.
Part of an 8-member Hall of Fame class, Hawkins started all 125 Bradley games and set 14 program records during his 4-year career from 1984 to 88. As a senior, he led the country in scoring at just over 36 points per game and was the consensus National Player of the Year.
You don't start off playing basketball as looking for, you know, personal accolades and things of that nature. But, you know, by the grace of God, going to the right school and having the right coaches and just everything sort of falling in place, you know, you end up having a good college career. And you know, this is the pedestal of it all, being inducted into the Hall of Fame.
A standout in high school at Chicago Westinghouse, Hawkins says Bradley was the ideal fit for him. He says coming to the Hilltop was a decision that came late in the recruiting process.
I played a lot of center in high school, and my coach actually invited Dick Versace, who was the coach at Bradley at the time, to a practice, and he let me play guard. And that's when Dick Versace decided that they were offering me a scholarship. So, you know, I was a mama's boy, so I didn't want to go far from home anyway. So, you know, it was 3 hours away where my parents could still come to the game. And, you know, just a great decision. I think my 4 years at Bradley, they have some of the most loyal and just outstanding fans. The fan support was wonderful. Of course, the school, you know, they rallied around us because we had some pretty good teams during my 4 years there. And I guess probably some of my most memorable times is just hanging out on campus, you know, walking across the quad, going to class and, you know, stopping, talking to students, having a good time like every other college student does. You know, you go there to have fun, to mature, to grow up. And I experienced all of those things with playing basketball. So, you know, a wonderful experience for me playing at Bradley.
Hawkins admits some of his motivation at Bradley came from not being recruited by bigger programs.
Coming out of high school, you know, I think everybody thinks that they're a power conference type player. And, you know, I thought about, you know, the fact that even being recruited out of high school, I was sort of overlooked. You know, when you play in Chicago and you win, you know, Chicago Player of the Year, but you're not recruited by any Big Ten schools or, you know, no DePaul or, you know, anything like that, then you sort of have to, I guess, have a little chip on your shoulder, because you have to prove that to those guys that you were capable of playing there. And plus, I know I needed to mature. I needed to go somewhere where I think a coach could take me under his wing, where I can not only, I think, play, because that's what you want to do, but you want to grow as a young man. And Dick Versace said he knew I would get an education. And that was extremely important to me, to go somewhere where I felt like that I would be not just an athlete, but also someone that a coach can can help mature as a person.
One of Hawkins' Bradley records is the single-game scoring mark of 63 points, set in a 122-107 win over Detroit Mercy in his senior season.
You know, when you score 63, it's, you know, an unbelievable night. And you're just, you know, you're feeling like everything you throw up is going in. It's one of the games that I, you know, sort of regret because I could have scored 70 or 75 if I would have just shot the ball a little more. But at some point, you know, when you've taken so many shots, I started feeling guilty during the game that I was shooting so much. So I started passing the ball. And, you know, just one of those memorable nights that, you know, the coaches know you're hot, your team know you're hot, and they just feed you and get you the ball and you take advantage of it.
The Braves went 26-5 in Hawkins' final year, winning the Missouri Valley Conference title but falling in the first round of the NCAA tournament.
There was a group of us that went in there together, you know, with Trevor Trempe and Donald Powell, and Jerry Thomas, Greg Jones. You know, the five of us had played our entire 4 years together. So it was one of those years where we wanted to go out with a bang. We wanted to give it all we had that year to make a serious push. And it was just one of those years that where it all came together. I mean, of course, we didn't win it all, but as a group, we knew what our ultimate goal was. And everyone for like the entire 4 years, but even more so my senior year, everyone sacrificed whatever they had to do in their game in order for us to win. And unfortunately, you know, we got knocked off by Auburn, but it was a good run for us.
That's Bradley basketball great Hersey Hawkins discussing his Hall of Fame induction with Joe Deacon.
The NPR One app is public radio made personal. The newly redesigned app now includes both audio and text stories from NPR, so you can read or listen on your own schedule. You can also hear WCBU's best stories and podcasts. Learn more at wcbu.org/NPR1.
This is All Things Peoria. I'm Daniel Musisi. Artist Daniel Ackley is the creator and editor of Central Illinois' newest art publication, Art Review. He overcame an unusual obstacle for a visual artist, visual impairment. I recently spoke with Daniel about Art Review and why he chose to start it here in Peoria.
I've always been interested in talking to fellow artists, and I've always had a keen fascination for what happens both inside the artist's studio and what happens inside the creative mind of the artist. And the pandemic came along, and we were all just staying home so much and not doing anything and just so bored and not knowing what to do next. And I just sat there for so many weeks and months during 2020 and just designed this concept for whenever I knew that it was going to be safe to do so. So I guess in my mind, in the back of my mind, I've always had this affinity for or love affair for talking with fellow artists and finding out what it is that makes them tick creatively, what it is that makes them get to the point through the process to that creative end product. And so it just seemed like a natural to start interviewing people. I started very, very slowly, and it's gained momentum, and 2022, sky's the limit in terms of the number of artists that exist.
So I guess with this curiosity of yours, you've also, it's enabled you to share these artists' voices with the community as well.
That's right. I was born with an eyesight disability. Originally, whenever I first started this arts newsletter concept, I only wanted to interview blind artists or artists with visual impairments and get to know what their creative process was. And so that's what led me to interviewing the world's most well-known blind artist, John Bramblett. And so I was able to interview him, and that was wonderful, a great experience. He and I talked on the phone for about an hour, and I learned so much from him about creativity and art and expression. And I knew that I still want to talk to a variety of artists with visual impairment, but there are so many other artists in Central Illinois that are just doing wonderful things. Holly B. Green, Natalie Jo Bell, Eric Scott, there are just so many different artists around, Sarah and the Underground, just any type of art form that you can think of. The artist that is part of that concept, I really, really would love to talk to them and find out what it is that makes them tick.
So about the content, I believe it mainly consists of artists' interviews. How do you choose your subjects?
It truly is an organic type of process. I do a lot of immersion into all the different social media concepts, and I'm always reading and I'm always looking for what artists are doing and listening to videos about art. And it just seems like I immerse myself in this art thing, and then whatever artist pops up to the top that I know viscerally is going to be the one that I want to choose next. So there's really no rhyme or reason to it. It's mainly just an intuitive feeling. It's that artist sensibility in me that wants to understand all the different types of art forms, you know, whether it be visual arts or dance or theater or anything that just cries out to me for some type of conversation. And then to tell that person's story is really, really compelling to me. I would really enjoy it if somebody came to me and wanted to be in my studio and talk to me about art. So I thought, why don't I just flip that around? And not only would it be wonderful for me to be an artist that creates on a regular basis, but to have the best of both worlds and talk to fellow artists.
So as you mentioned, Daniel, you're an artist as well. You're a photographer, and for a living, you're a political or editorial cartoonist, and your work appears in publications nationwide. Do you showcase your work in Art Review as well?
Whenever the first issue came out, there was a little bit of alluding to my political cartoons and my artwork and painting and those paintings and those types of things. But I tend to shy away in Art Review from my own artwork and head towards actually just commenting on various works of art at the end of the process or the issue.
This is All Things Peoria. I'm Daniel Musisi, here with artist and editor Daniel Ackley, discussing what led him to create his arts publication called Art Review. As a youth, you had cataracts and were legally blind up until the age of 18, when you had corrective surgery that repaired or restored your vision. What was it like to be visually impaired for the first 18 years of your life and then suddenly be given the ability to see?
Having a visual impairment was actually a blessing. It was something that I never thought of most of the time. 99% of the time, I didn't even think of myself as having an eyesight disability. But that other 1% definitely entered in whenever others could do certain types of sports or other types of events that I was unable to do. So most of the time, the structure of my family life was so wonderful, and all the people that I had in my life were so good to me, that it never really dawned on me for a long, long time that I had this eyesight disability, until when I was mainstreaming through public schools and I would have to walk up to the chalkboard and scribble down notes, being only just a couple of inches away from the chalkboard. Whenever I had to read and put the notebook or paper right up to my nose to be able to see, I had to look around that central cataract in order to see any type of low vision type of images. It dawned on me at some point in time that I had this eyesight situation, but I never thought that I would be able to correct it or overcome it. But in 1986, a local surgeon, he's awesome, Dr. Thomas Wyman at Illinois Eye Center, he performed dual intraocular lens implant surgery on both eyes. And so I essentially went from 2200 legal blindness to nearly 2020. And I always told people growing up that the old adage at that point then was true. I once was blind, but now I could see. And it was wonderful. And
wow. Can you talk about your journey or your experience becoming an artist amidst all that?
I would say my very first editorial cartoon happened in sixth grade when I drew an unflattering drawing and caricature of my sixth grade health teacher. And I'm very sorry for doing that. I apologize to him profusely. It was at the encouragement of all of my sixth grade classmates who knew that I could draw. So I could draw, they knew I could draw, and they asked me to draw, so I did. And that was just peer pressure, and I succumbed to the peer pressure. But even though the the drawing itself was inappropriate, it was a really good caricature, and it was my first editorial cartoon. Then as I transitioned into high school, I remember having a high school art class to where everybody in class sat at a big long table and they passed their finished artwork down the table to the very end to the teacher. And as the artwork was passed down, all of the students would look at each other's artwork and kind of critique it just to give each person a simple little art critique. And there was a really, really talented, the most talented and the best looking guy in the class. His name was Tony. He was the best artist and all the girls liked him and everybody looked up to him because he was awesome. As my artwork went down the table, Tony stopped and looked at it, and it was a caricature of Ronald Reagan. That's what I drew back then. And he kind of looked over at me and gave me the thumbs up signal and kind of, you know, just made that verbal face, you know, that nonverbal face to where he kind of gave me, that was really good stuff there. And so that encouraged me for some reason at a really, really young age that, caricature is something that I am good at.
That's Daniel Ackley, editor of Art Review. To learn more, visit WCBU.org. Thanks for choosing All Things Peoria on WCBU. I'm Daniel Musisi. We had story help today from Tim Shelley and Joe Deacon. You can find all of today's stories at WCBU.org. That's also where you'll find links to subscribe to the All Things Peoria podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, or NPR One. And we want to know what you think of the show, so comment on our Facebook page. We're Peoria Public Radio, or on Twitter at WCBU Radio. This is WCBU Peoria, 89.9 FM, and WCBU.org, a public service of Bradley University and Illinois State University.